podcast. In conversation with musicians from the UK jazz scene. And now your hosts, Rob Cope and Dan Farrant.
Hello and welcome to the Jazz Podcast. Today I am here with Dan as always. How's it going, Dan?
Doing well. Where are you, Rob? You sound like you're somewhere.
Apologies. I'm in the Tesco Extra Cafe, kind of above the tills. So, right. Yeah, I know. A pretty stupid place to make a podcast, one might
why,
say.
Why are you in Tesco Extra Cafe?
Because we're going to Glasgow after the show, and then once we're there... I'm pretty sure there's no reception in Scotland anywhere.
Oh.
Yeah, exactly. So I thought better get it done now.
Fair enough.
Yeah. I just don't know what we're going to find up there.
Do they have the internet there?
I don't know. I'll text you. I might have to send you a green old school text message to tell you what is there. But yeah.
Great.
So yeah, it's the Jazz Podcast. And before we get to Brigitte, let's do the news. I'd like to welcome Tom Miller back to London. I saw him last week, and he's moving back from Switzerland. He's a jazz piano player.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, Tom was a doer. I loved having Tom in London because he was a big part of the, like, I think, I'm not sure what the name was, like the Southwest London Collective or the SW Jazz, or they used to run gigs in Richmond and at the Orange Tree, at the Bull's Head. Tom's intolerant, like me, but stuff will happen with him here, so that's good news.
Great.
I know. Good times. Wow, I haven't said that for years. Good times. Also, Christine Turner, definitely a formal induction to the Jazz Mums secret underground network is required, because I know she's listening to the shows. She told me she listens to them when she washes up.
So,
high praise.
Take that.
Yeah, I'll take that any day. She's listening. That's what matters. So, it's a good example of ways to listen to the Jazz Podcast as well. You know, while you're doing something inane is perfect, because then you can listen to this inane noise.
Hopefully it will make the podcast go quicker. Doing something else as well.
Of course. Now, Rob Luft's album is out. Rob's a guitarist. His album is on Edition Records. It came out, it's called Riser. It came out a few days ago. And he has an album launch at King's Place on the 23rd of September. So we'll try and squeeze in a show with him before that album launch, and we can talk about it.
That'll be great.
Yeah. And for the finest piece of news, Gwilym Simcock got married on Wednesday.
How did he take you breaking the news to him
that I'd lost his show? He took it very well, and he said he'd do another one, and that he quite enjoyed the
that's
chat.
Nice of him.
Yeah, I know. So quite pleased with that. And Lawrence Cottle's gonna, I thought maybe do the two of them together because they're good friends.
Yeah.
And Lawrence thought the idea of him on his own was a little bit lame.
Okay.
Not that the show is lame.
It wouldn't be, but
I'd give Lawrence an A+ as a guest. I'm sure it would be stunning.
Yep.
So, Gwilym got married on Wednesday, and we played his
on
last...
Wednesday?
Yeah.
Who gets married on a Wednesday?
Yeah, well, I got married on a Thursday, I suppose.
Yeah, but Thursday's not Wednesday, is it?
No, that's true. So, we played Gwilym's last gig as a single man last week. And it ended with him directing an arrangement that he'd done himself of Sex Bomb for 10 saxophones and rhythm section, and dedicating it to his fiancée, who was in the audience.
I have to say, that sounds like it would have been horrendous.
I haven't actually confirmed whether the wedding's still gone ahead.
Okay.
After that incident.
Were you one of those 10 saxophones?
Oh, I was, Dan. Yes, thank you for asking. Yeah. So, let's play Brigitte's show.
Right, yes, do it.
So, where are you at the moment?
Well, I'm at home. This is a day off. and very much enjoying it. So I'm in North London. I'm in Palmer's Green.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. What about you?
I am doing the same thing in Southwest London.
So, okay. We're very far from each other.
Yeah.
And yet, so close.
Yeah, I know. It's such a lovely day, isn't it?
Oh, it's amazing, yeah. And here it's very, very peaceful where I am, so it's lots of green. And I would be in the garden right now, but the connection wouldn't be so good. So
that's exactly what I thought. Not worth the risk of the sunshine for our poor listeners, of which there are many, of course. So, Palmer's Green, how far out is that? I might go on the map.
Palmer's Green is not very far. It feels not many people know about it, but it's actually about 20 minutes from Moorgate, so you can just take the the over. You're there in 20 minutes, so it's really easy.
That's amazing. And I just Googled it, and the first thing that comes up is Palmer's Green, hidden London.
Oh, yeah, apparently someone told me that they came back from holiday and they were, I don't know, so it probably wasn't Heathrow, but somewhere like Luton or Stansted.
Yeah.
And there was, you know, pictures as they were going out of the airport. They saw pictures on the left of Big Ben and then picture on the right of Palmer's Green.
Fantastic. So, you've made it.
Apparently that's the place to be.
That's great. Well, yeah, there's like a whole website dedicated to what you just said, which is that no one knows about it.
Is there? Maybe you should send me the link so I find out a bit more about it.
I'll totally do that. That's a fantastic idea. So let's get to work.
Oh, okay.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in the south of France. So I was born in Italy. I lived in Milan for the first 2-3 years of my life. And then we moved to...
Sorry about that noise. That was,
what was that?
I just sent you that link. Sent
to me. Oh, thank you.
Sorry.
And then we moved to the south of France, so we were sort of Monaco, Nice, Menton, the very southeast of France.
Oh, basically. Wow, that sounds so nice.
Yeah, it's absolutely beautiful. And I mean, I guess, you know, as a kid, maybe I didn't realize how lucky I was and how amazing it was. But yeah, it certainly is incredible. Yeah, just sea, sun. Mountain.
It's a wonderful coastline, isn't it? It's so lovely.
Yeah, it really is.
So what made you leave? I can't imagine ever leaving if I was living there.
Yeah, everyone says that. But, you know, it's just when you live somewhere, however beautiful it is, I think you sort of, you know, want to start seeing elsewhere. And also I realized that actually the... because I was a lot of where I grew up was actually Monaco itself, so it's actually a very weird place.
Yeah, I went once and it was so quiet. It was so weird. Yeah,
it's like once you step out of it and you see kind of what life is outside, you sort of realize that it might not, you know, that it might not be. I don't know. It's quite strange. And also, I just was ready to sort of see elsewhere and. Yeah. I wasn't quite, I did, after finishing school, I did a year of law, studying law in Nice, and very quickly realized that this was not for me.
Yeah.
And so I, you know, sort of was at the time where I was kind of searching a little bit, and then I thought, okay, what about Paris or what about London? And my brother was already in London. My mum at the time was in London as well. Mm-hmm. So I moved there and started doing sort of went away from the law and started doing music basically, and never looked back.
How were you like 19 then when you moved to London?
Yeah, I think that's about right. I was 19, 20, yeah. And when I moved to London, I sort of, it was quite funny because at the time I was really into drama, into theatre. I was doing quite a lot of it in back down south, and And I sort of started searching for like really nice places to study drama. And then I stumbled upon the Guildhall School of Music and Drama and thought, that sounds nice. Mm. So I walked through the doors and went to the reception and said, hi, I'd like to study here. And then the woman, I remember laughing at me. She said, well, you have to apply and this would be for next year. And so I really didn't know how the system worked. And then eventually, as I was searching, I sort of found this place. I was, you know, kind of thinking a lot about things at the time. And then I thought, okay, what about music?
Yeah.
Found this place. I had been playing the piano since I was, you know, quite young, but I didn't have enough skills to go to uni really. So then I found this amazing A-level, actually, music A-level, which was actually catered for all ages. So there were 16-year-olds there as well as 55-year-olds there.
Right.
And I went there. It was Kingsway College, and it was really special. 2 years, it was absolutely amazing. I met people that I'm still really close to now, and that's when I first actually started getting into the jazz a little bit more, because I wasn't aware of the jazz side of things before that.
Yeah. Really.
Yeah.
There you go. No, there's so many ways to go right now. So when you started learning piano, how did that come about? Did one of your parents make you?
My dad was a piano player. Well, he's still alive, but he's not a piano player anymore. My dad's Turkish, and in his teens, when he was, you know, 16-ish, he played piano for this, I can't remember his name sadly, but a very famous Turkish pop star.
Yeah.
So he played piano with him, and but then sort of moved away from that. But I grew up with him always sort of playing piano and singing with his very, very raucous voice, and just playing like kind of variety type stuff, you know, more sort of like, oh, sole mio, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so I grew up with that sort of like really always loving him being at the piano. And then my mum it was quite late really, when I was about 12 or 13, she got me some piano lessons. And before that, I was just experimenting on the piano and just enjoying playing lots of like Beatles stuff and that kind of thing, you know. Yeah.
Cool. So when you were at Kingsway, do you remember anyone in particular that, like, you know, you said you met some people that you're still, like, people that you still play with or just are in touch with?
Yeah, the people that I'm still in touch with and people I'm still playing with as well, but particularly the two people who are still connected to me in a sort of, in a jazz context, I suppose, in a musical context. First one being George Hart, who's an absolutely incredible drummer.
Yeah.
And, so he's on my first two albums, and we're still really really good friends, and we still play together. He's in the current band Solstice that I'm in, and he was an absolutely, for me, you know, just meeting him, it was incredible when I first went into that place and I realized that he was playing not only drums but also guitar and saxophone and bass and
wow, cool. And
it was just, you know, sort of an eye opener.
Yeah,
it's just watching someone who had a very different upbringing to mine, I suppose, who was just like bathed in music since a really young
age.
That's
a wonderful description, bathed in music.
Yeah, and he was very much, and so I sort of we started playing a lot, and so he, you know, he introduced me to a lot of music, a lot of the more kind of sort of fusion side of jazz, I suppose, which for me was absolutely amazing. We also used to go to Ronnie Scott's every year to see Ayuta Morera and Flora Purim. And for me, that was just like, you know, when I saw that for the first time, I just thought the music was incredible. And also the energy and the, the passion of these guys on stage, I was just thinking, you know, I want to be that. And then there was also this other guy called Bruno Rollet, who was a Belgian guy who plays the saxophone, who lives in near Brussels, and who I was sort of quite resistant to jazz for a while. Mm-hmm. And he, because I was, you know, really into classical music and contemporary classical stuff.
Yeah.
And he introduced me to John Coltrane, and he when he first played it to me, I was just like, oh, what is this?
Ow.
And he was really persistent, and I'm so thankful that he was. I don't know whether he must have brainwashed me, wow. But it was one of, you know, during that time when you kind of, you can stay at someone's house for like 3 days and it's okay because you don't have anything else to do, sort of thing. And he just would, I know it sounds a bit weird, but he would sort of almost like lock me in the room and make me listen to Love Supreme round and round and round until eventually I was just like, yeah, I get it. This is really cool, you know? And so from then on, so really it's thanks to these guys, I suppose, well, you know, they just, I just sort of started looking around for more stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's really cool that he worked so hard to brainwash you.
Yeah, worked. So it's his fault or thanks to him, whichever way you want to put it, really.
Yeah, that's really something. I'm going to have to try that with somebody.
Yeah, it might not work. No. They might not be very happy, but give it a go.
So was there anything else that was like, I mean, do you remember the moment when you were like, okay, fine, that's it. I'll be a jazz musician.
Well, I think that was probably when, because I did an undergraduate in classical music actually before doing the jazz thing. So, you know, even though these two guys introduced me to jazz, I still didn't think that I could possibly do anything connected to being a jazz musician and improvise. So it was, I think it was as I was, you know, discovering about this, because I was still a classical piano player, really, not very good, but that's what I did.
Right.
And studying contemporary classical music and all that kind of stuff.
But not as a singer, as a pianist.
No, as a pianist. And then, but then also during Kingsway, even though I went the piano playing route, I didn't think I was going to be a performer, by the way. I thought it was going to be more something else, just writing about music, or I wasn't sure really at that point. I was singing a bit at Kingsway and people tended to be quite complimentary about it. And I really enjoyed it as well. And then I was really into the jazz at that point. And I switched when I was in my second year at uni.
Yeah.
Is that, hello? Hello? Oh,
so I think that's the noise your Skype makes when someone signs into it.
Okay.
I haven't figured out, if I knew how to mute it, I'd tell you, but this podcast has made all kinds of weird and wonderful sounds.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, it's the worst I get is that I can't figure out how to mute iMessages, so if anyone texts me during the whole interview, then it'll be a noise.
Oh, but that's right. It just shows that it's all, you know, on the moment.
Exactly. At least we're busy. People seem to want to be in touch with us.
Exactly. I must have turned my phone onto silent, surely. yeah, so what was I saying? Yeah, so the second year of Goldsmiths, I switched to singing, classical singing, and then eventually switched to jazz. But I think the defining moment for me was when I then went on to the Glamorgan Summer School. That would have been, quite a while ago. And just met, Pete Churchill. It's always Pete, isn't it?
Yeah.
Pete Churchill, who was leading the vocal group. And then also meeting a peer singer, Nia Lin.
Yes.
Who she was, you know, both of us were so excited and just so into, you know, the same recordings, and I think, and the joy, you know, just the joy of that place, and meeting Steve Watts and meeting Simon Purcell as well, who's incredible. I was hooked at that point. It was just a few days, and that was it for me to realize that, you know, that's what I wanted to do. And I think that's the case with a lot of people who went to these summer schools.
Yeah.
But I guess a lot of people who go to these summer schools already know beforehand that that's what they want to do. But for me, I think that was when I decided I was gonna delve more into the jazz thing.
And yeah, that's when you were, and then you knew, of course, that you had to apply at Guildhall a year in advance. So you could.
But by that point, yes, I was very wise by then. I applied, and then I got in, and it was just on a postgrad.
Mm-hmm.
And just a year at the time, 1 year postgrad. And it was the most intense, beautiful, horrible, incredible thing. It was just, a year that felt like it lasted 2 seconds and 10 years at the same time.
I know how you. I have a very similar CV to you: classical undergrad and then a jazz master's.
Okay.
And yeah, for me, I came to London to do mine because I just thought I'd be eaten alive.
Yeah.
I've been eaten alive anyway, but just slightly more slowly, I think. You know, just with the quality of playing here, you know.
It's absolutely incredible, isn't it? It just shocks me every time, but in a good way. I think it's really amazing, and sort of, you know, at the you come to London and you think, oh, I'm okay, I'm quite good, and then you meet all these other people, and you become, yes, all of a sudden there's a lot of how I call it, humility.
Good word. So do you ever think you'd leave London?
I don't, right now I don't think so. I think I can finally call this place home, really. Yeah. You know, I've realized that I've been in London longer than I've been in France, which was quite a shock to
my
sister.
Wow, yeah.
And maybe, you know, when I'm older and I retire and have loads of money, I might I was going to say possibly go back somewhere that's sunny and it's got mountains and things, but I don't think so. My feeling is I just really like it here, and if I went anywhere, maybe it would be Scotland or somewhere.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah,
I could do that, but I think it keeps you young living here. The people I know that, and we did, when I was at Academy, my friend Jack Davies won this Deutsche Bank Prize, and we made like a couple albums with the money. And he did an album launch at the Forge, and his 94-year-old gran came.
Wow.
I know, and she's just like walking around and chatting and eating, and it was really something, you know. And I think, like, staying in London, like, it must make you, I don't know, it seems like you can basically leave the house into your 90s.
Yeah, no, I think so. And I mean, who knows what will happen. But right now, being in this beautiful Palmer's Green or Palmer's Greek,
mm-hmm.
some people call it, it's just perfect because, you know, I don't necessarily feel like I'm in London right now. It's quite suburban and it's so calm. And then, you know, 20 minutes away and I'm just back in the hustle and bustle, and I can see myself doing that when I'm 90, but we'll see. We'll hopefully have another chat at that point.
Definitely. Well, this show is never stopping. It's just what I'm going to do is interview everyone.
Yeah.
Like in the UK, and then when I'm finished, I'll just go round again.
Yeah.
And then we'll all be catching up like 5 years later or something, and we'll just do it like that over and over again.
By that time, we'll all be a little bit wiser, a little bit older.
Exactly.
A little bit sillier.
Sunbury-on-Thames is a little further out of town than where you are.
Okay.
But I drove to the Barbican on Sunday.
Yeah.
And it only took me like an hour to get there. And I always am like, I literally live in central London. Like,
yeah.
Like, even though I clearly don't. Journeys like that reaffirm my belief that it's actually like the middle of London.
Where it's Yeah. No, that's good.
And also, just for any listeners that might need to, probably don't need to know this, the Barbican, you can park there for £9 for the entire day at the weekend.
Well, or you could cycle there.
For nothing. I like it.
And probably the journey from your home to there would be so lush. Wouldn't you go via the river and, you know?
Yeah, you could. I see what you're saying. You could cycle along the Thames path. It's quite a long way. It's about 14 miles, I think.
Well, then you're saying you can leave your car for the weekend, so presumably you're planning on spending a couple of days there, so it'll be worth it.
Yeah, that goes against my theory of living in central London. If I'm so far away that when I go into town, you like booking a hotel and stay for several days.
Yeah, that's true.
But yeah. So, when you finished Guildhall, what did you do? What happened?
I don't remember.
When did you graduate?
I graduated in 2002, I think.
Right, okay.
So I lived, at the time I lived in Leighton, mm-hmm. East London, and I think I was a little bit nervous because, you know, as you're, when you're finishing college, yeah, a lot of us don't quite, are not quite sure whether they're going to be able to make it, and as in be able to stay in London and live in London and be okay.
Yeah.
So I started putting loads of ads in the newspaper and trying to get a little bit of work, you know, one-to-one singing lessons. And so I would go to people's houses and, so it was quite a tricky time because you don't really know who you're going to get, and there's some amazing things that happened along the way. But it was just surviving, singing lessons and doing a few gigs here and there, and then slowly, you know, building it up. I did make an album when I left Guildhall. I didn't feel like I was ready to make an album, but I thought, you know, got to start somewhere. And if I'm too much of a perfectionist, I will never make an album. So, So started there, and then slowly.
That one's called Prelude to a Kiss.
That's the one. Yeah, that's the one. So that was 2004. I think.
It says 2005 on your biography.
I think it was, we recorded it in 2004, maybe.
Yeah.
And that was with Barry Green and Phil Duncan, who were both at Guildhall with me. And then I had Ivo Neame and George Hart, who were in the same year, I think, at the Academy. Mm-hmm. And then Ingrid Laubrock and Anita Wardell guesting as well.
Wow, that's super cool.
Yeah, it was just so amazing for me, you know, just to, these guys. Ivo had a band with both Phil and George at the time as well. So these guys were playing together. I said Ivo, but Prelude to a Kiss is with Barry, isn't it? I'm getting confused now. Flying Dreams was with these guys.
Flying Dreams was with Ivo.
Ivo, and then Prelude to a Kiss was with Barry. So, yeah, so the Prelude to a Kiss was a more standards album.
Yeah.
And that's who I was still playing with Barry to this day. You know, just love playing with him. But we were more kind of like standards based, I suppose. No, go on.
I was just going to say, I when I went to the Barbican, I always think of him when I'm there. That's like that's the guy I associate with that whole flat, and I think he still lives in there.
He does. Yeah, it's a funny thing. But yes, absolutely. Barbican equals Barry.
Well,
and all as well a bit, I suppose. But yeah.
Such a good marketing slogan. So tell us about the second album then. Let's go through them all.
Okay. Oh, trying to remember. Second album was Flying Dreams, and I think that was 4 years later, so who knows what I did for 4 years. and so that was, yes, with Ivo, and I hope I'm getting this right, Ivo and Phil and George and Joe Auckland on trumpet and flugelhorn. And that was all originals, most of mine as well as some of Ivo's, or one of Ivo's. Mm-hmm. And some of the album has some trio numbers, just piano, trumpet and voice, and some with a full band. The reason being, I think, was because we did loads of touring with a trio, so we it was just, I suppose, easier as well. And I just loved that sound, you know, obviously Azimuth.
Yeah.
Influence, so I'm hoping that we don't sound anything like it because it's such different music, but still it was a big influence.
Yeah.
And yeah, and that album, I mean, obviously I don't really listen to me, but it was a very, I'm quite proud of it in a way, because it was a very, it was the first like proper, you know, original thing that I did. And,
yeah.
And I thought the guy sounded absolutely amazing on it. Really great. And yeah, it just felt really good. I mean, I remember listening back to it, or just a track recently, someone mentioned it and I listened to it, and it just feels like I was so young, but that's how it goes, I guess.
Yeah.
But I still enjoyed it, you know, I still enjoyed listening to it.
That project, in case anyone's listening a little confused, Azimuth is with John Taylor and Kenny Wheeler and Norma Winston. That's just so obscene. There's one track in particular that I'm really obsessed with, that I've always been, with this like little loop thing that goes round and round. It's like 10 minutes long, really simple little piece.
Yeah.
That John's got some kind of loop going, and Kenny and Norma just, you know, do some stuff.
Improvise on it, overlay. Is that the one? Well, there's loads of those. There's a few of those, isn't there, where Kenny just overlays loads of the trumpets?
Yeah, I haven't really given anyone a chance of knowing what on earth it is that I was talking about there. I might just play some of it at the end of the interview.
Yeah, you should. So beautiful, so hypnotic as well. It's great. I love that sound. Yeah, haven't heard it in a while. I might put it on after our chat.
Yeah, these words are trying to mix Kenny's and John Taylor's names, but they're really the two that inspired the whole podcast to start. Out of regret, really, of how much I'd have loved to sit and talk to them, you know. And then, you know, we figured, get on with it.
Yeah.
You've done a lot of tour dates on that as well. Can see some...
Which, the Flying Dreams thing. Yeah. I think we did a 20-date tour in 2007 and then another 20-date tour in 2008, I think.
That's amazing. That's like the total number of gigs I've done in my whole life. So let's talk about, why don't we talk about Reuben Fowler, because that's how we met.
Reuben! Mm-hmm. Yes! Oh. Well, Reuben Fowler, I haven't actually seen Reuben in a very long time.
He's looking amazing at the moment.
I have seen him like a few months ago, very briefly, and he seemed so happy and he looks great. He seemed very happy, but yeah, that project was absolutely great. And you know, Reuben is such an amazing musician, amazing writer, amazing arranger, as you know.
He has an album out. If we're discussing an album called Between Shadows, which is an album Reuben wrote for big band, which featured yourself, and it featured Stan Saltzman, it featured Jim Hart, and it featured Tom Harrell on trumpet, as well as kind of people like Percy Persglove, who would maybe be at the top of the bill. I think Percy was relegated to, like, just, even though he's got loads of, he's got an amazing solo on the, on Richard Turner's tune.
It was an incredible project, incredible album, and I was so happy to be part of it, you know, and it's exactly the kind of thing that I just love and relish in doing, just using my voice as an instrument, and I wrote words to one bit, and it was originally, I think it was, we first met, I think that's right. I think we first met on only 17 large ensemble gig.
Right.
There's a 17 jazz collective that I'm part of. Amazing musicians. And he was, I think he was just basically depping in a rehearsal and for a gig. And that's where we met. And he heard me in a context, which I think, you know, he was writing, obviously for a large ensemble. And I think that was before, I think he was still at the Academy at the time. And he was, it was before his final recital. And he was thinking of using voice at the time. And I think, luckily, when he heard me, he thought that it was fitting in really well with what he was writing at the time. And so I sung on his recital. And it was, I seem to remember I was singing throughout the whole thing. It was a different, slightly different thing to the album itself. But the song that I wrote, which was connected to the whole story of his final recital, was kept in the writing of his new album.
So, did you set words to something he'd written?
Yeah,
How did you go about that? Because that sounds really hard. Because you don't have like full ownership even of the melody you're kind of working with.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember now because I haven't revisited the music for a very long time.
I listened to that album quite a lot, just even though I play bass clarinet on it, and they've turned it very, very suspiciously low in the mix. You have to really work to hear the bass clarinet.
Oh, no.
I know.
Oh, dear. I listened to it for quite a bit for a long time as well. Yet another one that I have to dig out again. Yeah. You know, I've heard it for a few years now, but basically, when he wrote the music for his final recital, I mean, he can tell you about it. It was, I can't remember what the story was, but it was all connected to a story. And Ruben told me about it, and it was basically I already had a story in my hands that I could use to write.
Oh, wow, cool.
So and also I connected that to our experience of knowing each other, and you know, Ruben having a really good sense of humor, and I think I used a really good sense of humor, Ruben. And I used some of that. I think it's some of it. I'll have to dig it out, really. But some of it has mentions that the color purple or something like that, which was connected at the time. I remember he had these purple shoes that I was really coveting because they were just so amazing. And he said that he would get me a pair. Ruben, if you're listening to this. And so somehow I managed to sort of connect that collar with, I can't remember if I brought the shoes in, but in the text of this, of his tune.
Forgetting who we are and who we used to be. To pretend you
Did you get the shoes?
I don't know if I'm surely not thinking of, but I must have used the collar. Was it purple? Yeah. Lilac. I have to check now, and now you're going to check. You're going to say, what is she talking about? There's no whatsoever. But I think it was a little bit of a sort of like, remember what you said? You were going to get me a pair of those shoes. I think it was a little bit too subtle.
We'll start the campaign for them now then. We can put a lot of pressure on now. No problems.
But yeah, so I already knew, I had a story, and then I think his writing was just so melodic and just so beautiful that it really felt, it didn't feel difficult, you know, it felt organic to me, whereas I don't know whether for the listener it will feel the same, but...
Well, I'll play it. I've got it here. I'll stick it on after we finish and people
and
can...
We'll check whether there's any reference to shoes or some collar.
It'll be great, because after all this story, immediately it's going to be very, very clear.
Yes, what's... I apologise if that's not the case. I must have rewritten it, but that's what I remember. Let's see, eh?
Oh, man. So what's going on at the moment in life?
Oh, well, at the moment, musically, just finished that amazing tour with Solstice. I don't know if you're familiar with that band, but it's basically...
Can you tell us about it?
Yeah, so it's basically a sextet. It's a collaboration, talking about collaborations, mm-hmm. With John Terville on piano, Jess Franks on guitar, Tori Freestone on saxes and flute, George Hart on drums, Dave Mannington on double bass, and myself. And we basically all write for this band, which is really fun. I tend to write lyrics for Dave's tunes because we have that kind of collaboration already.
Yeah.
With his band, Riff Raff, which maybe we'll talk about in a minute if we've got time. It's basically we're all these guys and live in East London, Walthamstow, very close to there. And so we've connected to that E17 Jazz Collective. So we've known each other for a really long time now. So we're really good friends as well, and we sort of started, you know, well, as you do, just having dinners and stuff, dinner parties and having plays, and then just playing music that we all, love, like that kind of Hametto Pasquale thing, things with loads of lines, Pierre de Bettman, that kind of stuff. And then from there we started writing our own music, and we made an album. And the album is called Alimentation because that's connected to our love of food, basically.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of sort of food titles and stuff. And we just did a 20-day tour to promote the album, and it was just amazing. It was just great, great fun. And then we also, during the tour, we started playing some new and writing some new tunes, which we're about to record another album in September as well. We've been quite it was a slow burner, but now we're doing it, so it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun, and it's very sort of I suppose contemporary music, sort of with a lot of lines, so it's quite dense really, but people seem to think it's also really melodic and really fun, so it's a good combination.
Sounds like you guys have been really busy, a second album.
Yeah, we have, which is, it's been great fun. And all the other guys are really busy doing other stuff as well. But sort of when we come together, I think it's quite a nice release as well, because we know each other really well. And it's hard music, but it's, we have fun with it, which is great. But that's finished just for the summer, I suppose, and then we'll get back together in September when we're recording. And then in the meantime, well, it's going to be a little bit quiet on the music front for me for a couple of months, because I'm doing it's a summer schools time, so I'll be teaching on a few summer schools.
Yeah.
I'm doing 4 weeks of that, starting at the end of July. And before that, I'm going to Manchester Jazz Festival to play with André Canier's band.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, it's a really nice band as well. It's he's basically written music to poetry, inspired by poetry by Bukowski and Maria Rilke. I'm not sure that's how you pronounce the name. And but yeah, beautiful poetry. And so my role is mainly just to sing that that poetry, you know, over the music that he's written. And the band's great as well. So André on trumpet, Ivo Neem on piano. The same Tori.
Yeah, no, that's really cool.
Stone, Michael Janish and Andrew Bain. So doing that, and then other little bits and bobs. Up until now, I've been. Recently I did a really nice thing, which was my interpretation of Les Parapluies de Cherbourg, which was, I don't know if you're familiar with that.
Not
film.
Not at all. Like, so, what is it?
It's a French film. Which was, what would it be, a 60s, maybe, late 60s film with Catherine Deneuve and with a score by Michel Legrand. Excuse me. And it's basically one of those really iconic movies. And growing up in France, that's a film that every French person would have seen, you know, in the... as a teen. It's basically this love story, but it's all sung, so it's like musical or almost like an opera.
Yeah.
I guess, because even when they speak about going to volleyball tonight, they're singing. I mean, it's really odd, it's really weird, but yeah. The cinematography is absolutely amazing and the music is absolutely amazing. But anyway, so there was this screening a couple of weeks ago in South Kensington at the French Institute, and they asked me to do my interpretation of the music.
That's cool. That
John, before the screening, and then the Q&A after that. And that was like quite fun, really, really interesting for me also, you know, sort of to marry the two, because I don't do that very often, to sort of go back to my French heritage and then use that in my music. And so that was lovely.
That's really cool, yeah.
And then what else have I been doing? I've been doing lots of the stuff which is really exciting at the moment, is that it seems like I'm doing more of a cross thing between jazz and classical, so I get to do and more experimental stuff. So recently I was involved with this... a big concert for Basil Kirchin. I don't know if you're familiar with him. He was a drummer and wrote for films and also for ads, but also like we did some really experimental stuff. So we did a big thing with a BBC concert orchestra and playing his music basically, and world premieres with Will Gregory, and I had to use my voice. I had to sort of pretend that I was a bird. So that was quite intense. So I had a machine which would take my voice up an octave, and I had to imitate birds, or rather than imitate birds, it was more my interpretation of birds and just doing really weird stuff with that, and an amazing violinist called Charles Mutter, Will Gregory, and then Evan Parker was involved, Eddie Parker and Martin Franz, and loads of amazing people. And there's loads of stuff I can't quite talk about yet, but connected to this more sort of big projects, connected to more sort of like free stuff, but also using classical and contemporary classical element, which I think my voice is quite suited for. And also the fact that, you know, I love, you know, that's, I grew up with contemporary classical music, and I just love it. So yeah. It'll be so nice for me to be able to marry, you know, my passions so that's exciting as well.
Yeah, that's really cool. Bird thing sounds really hard.
Yeah, it is, but you know, it gets me excited to do challenging things and new things, and now also I never listen to birds in the same way since. Yeah. it's very strange, like kind of different realities, hearing things in completely different ways now when you know after you've done a certain project or a certain thing.
Yeah.
Sort of life looks different, but I like that. Yeah,
definitely. I've done that to myself with jazz, you know, ruined tracks, yeah. But I've never ruined like the sound of an animal through like over analysis.
Ruined. Did you say ruined?
Ruined. Yeah, ruined. I get that with like if I transcribe something, I listen to it so much that by the time I'm done, it's ruined. I don't want to hear it ever again.
Oh yeah. No, I completely know what you mean. Yeah. But then you'll come back to it in a year's time, and then you'll love it again, and you'll listen to it with completely fresh ears. You know, that's just how it works.
Yeah. I usually can't remember the transcription either.
Really?
Yeah. After about a year, it's gone, which is probably. A bad sign.
Are you sure you're doing it properly?
Yeah, I am. I could do it from, you know, I could play the whole solo from memory, then leave it for a while, come back to it, and it's like I never did it.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
That's just what happens if you're an idiot, I guess.
No, but it's really interesting because I think I'm quite good at remembering things like that, and yet I might read what I'm really bad with is watching a movie or reading a book, even those that I really loved, and then they could just erase from my memory. Yeah. And then, you know, 2 weeks later, someone might ask me what was this book about, and I can't tell them. It's just so sad. And yet, in other ways, it's not, because you can then rediscover it all over again, don't you?
As I choose to with the Harry Potter books.
Yeah, I do.
One of my friends, a guy called Mitch Jones, he's a pianist, and when we were at school, we used to muck about together all the time, and yet he would always get really good exam results, and I would get really terrible ones, and I realised, and it was happening with his piano playing as well, he just had such a ridiculous memory, that it was just like, he's just like floated through life on the back of this ability to hear something once and immediately retain it permanently.
That's very frustrating.
It's annoying to be friends with someone like that.
Yeah.
He should be terrible at the piano, but he's not. He's really good at it.
I wonder what he would say about you. He would probably say, oh, yes, but you were so good at that. And
I'm sure he would be overwhelmingly full of praise. I might text him to get some quotes.
Ask him. Yeah. You can let people know for the next podcast.
So I have a few more questions for you.
Mm.
One of them, I stopped asking ages ago, and I've gotten some abuse for the lack of it.
Please
for asking people what their favourite album is. They're kind of they have an all-time, you know, one that you would be incredibly fond of saying.
I find these questions so difficult.
That's why I stopped asking it, because the guests...
I'll tell you one. What popped into my head just now, but I won't regret saying it. Is Wayne Shorter's Native Dancer. Mm. I absolutely adore that album.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, but you know, one album. It's just tricky, isn't it? There's so many.
Very. But that's part of the magic of this question.
Yeah, but that's what popped into my head. Would you have asked me tomorrow, I would have said something else. But there you go. Native Dancer. Yeah, absolutely adore that.
This sounds like the beginning of loads of stupid questions, but it's not.
Okay.
if you could be like a professional sports person,
yes.
What sport would you play?
Tennis.
That's nice. That's very nice.
Yeah. Why? Why is it nice?
Why is it nice?
Yeah.
Because tennis is so civilised, especially Wimbledon. Everyone's wearing white. You're playing on freshly mown grass. You know, you get warned if you swear or do anything, you know, ungentle, unsporting. You know, just like, I don't know, it's a very civilised way to go. Yeah.
Well, it depends, I suppose, because I was recently watching. So I was telling a friend that I haven't actually watched Wimbledon for quite a long time, but I used to really be into it when I was little, when I was younger. and there were, you know, they used to be, the players used to play with so much more, in my mind anyway, so much more character, and they wouldn't worry about being silly. And I don't know if you're familiar with Nastasi or John McEnroe. Mm-hmm. You know, these guys, like John would get so upset and would just start swearing all over the place, and Nastasi would just be a buffoon on the court. And you wouldn't really see that done so much now, I guess. It's just so, I guess what you're saying as well, it's just so nice, you know, it's just everyone's so, they're not doing the wrong thing, or, but it used to be very different. And that's, I suppose that's also part of why I answered tennis.
Yeah. What, thinking, so you could shake it up again?
No, I was just thinking, just, you know, I'd love to be that kind of, even though that's, in a way, that's not my character, but that kind of Nastasi character where you sort of, it's almost like he was, you know, as soon as he was going on the court, he would go on stage and then he would entertain kids, but he would also play amazing tennis, you know. So it's, I suppose it's like thinking about that and just yeah, it's like the whole package. That's what I, yeah. I want to be a tennis player.
That'd be lovely. You'd be outside loads and getting fresh air and all that.
Nice. Oh, well. Never mind. Next life.
Next life. There's still time.
I'm so sure about that, but thank you, Rob.
I just really hope that reincarnation's a thing. And I can come back and listen to all these episodes all
is
over
that
again.
What you would choose to do? No offense, but
that's my deepest ambition. Is remember Peter Jackson said that about Lord of the Rings? He wanted to be hypnotized and watch it without knowing that he made it, so he could see what he really thought.
Amazing! Oh yeah. No.
And obviously, the jazz podcast is on the same artistic level as the Lord of the Rings trilogy.
Of course it is.
So what about food? Let's talk about favourite foods.
Favourite foods. I absolutely adore Japanese food.
Mm-hmm.
I love raw fish. There is a restaurant in Putney, East Putney, and if anyone's interested.
East Putney, that's not too far. I could cycle there.
You should go, absolutely. It's called Tomoe, Tomoe.
Right.
And it's like nothing from the outside, but you go in and as far as I'm aware, I used to go to other places which have shut in, you know, since. This is my favourite place in London at the moment. And sadly, they've taken the prices up recently, but it's still okay, especially if you go at lunchtime.
Yeah.
You do special deals and stuff. Yeah, so that's a great one. I also adore Mediterranean food. I guess that's also connected to my upbringing. I love Italian food, and that's just just beautiful produce, beautiful vegetable and fruit, and the Mediterranean are absolutely amazing at that. So Turkish food as well, and Italian food, yeah. But I like food a lot. So
yeah.
All sorts of good, you know, food coming from anywhere. Like if it's good, if it's really good, then I'm up for it.
Yeah.
Yeah. What about you? Well, people probably know this already, don't they?
I have a low metabolism, so I have to cycle everywhere in order to eat anything.
Me too.
You know, yeah, I have to work very hard to look quite bad. But probably Indian food, like authentic Indian food, like cooking with lentils and mung beans.
Absolutely, yeah.
That would be, if I could only eat like one type of food forever. I just like how a couple of spices can really change things. Like you say, like nice Italian food. I really like the simplicity when it's like you just cook it well.
Mm.
You know.
Yeah.
There's nowhere to hide with Italian food if it's just
It could be so bland, couldn't it? If you don't have the right produce and you don't know how to cook pasta, then you're in trouble. But I'm just assuming it will be good Italian if I have it.
Yeah, I've definitely become a food snob.
Yes, I I must say I probably am, but yeah.
It's okay. We can go to that fish restaurant and we can join a support group.
Yes, let's.
Oh, man. Bridget, thank you so much for coming on the Jazz Podcast.
Oh, no, you're very, very welcome. Thanks for having me.
It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure as well. Sad it's over.
Yeah, I am. I've run out of intelligent and unintelligent questions.
Oh, never mind, eh? In 5 years' time, when we do the roundup, we can
yes,
talk.
Yes, yes.
This time.
Perfect. And then you can listen back to this to see what it was you were doing at the time.
Oh, no. All right. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks for coming on. And we'll speak to you soon.
Soon, yeah. Take care.
Marvellous. Bye.
So, Dan, before we go, I met up with Kit Downs last week after his Manchester Jazz Festival gig. And we made a mini jazz podcast review show. So this is a little bonus encore.
Keep it in the family. Yeah. This time I can beat James.
Yeah.
That's my sole mission.
This show is going to go huge and get more listens than James Matron's show.
James isn't on this show, is he?
No. This is where we evaluate our playing. So,
did you play?
I played on Tuesday.
Ah, yeah, of course. Have you done an evaluation for yourself?
No, I'm going to ring up the guy I played with in a minute and get him to evaluate my playing.
It's going to be awkward.
Yeah, very.
I mean, I'm assuming it went well, so maybe it'll be fine.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know me. It's all a bit hit and miss. So, how was that for you?
It was very nice, yeah. Very enjoyable.
Sounded cool. Grand piano in a church.
It's good. Yeah, it's got all the ingredients. Now, it's the third time we've done this gig, and it's all Paul Motion music.
Yeah, one at the Vortex.
One at the Vortex, one at Ealing Jazz Festival, and then this one. And Lauren's written music to all, not all of them, but quite a few of Paul Motion's tunes.
Oh, lyrics.
Yeah.
Sweet.
Those were lyrics.
You called them music.
What?
You said she's written music to
Paul
Motion.
She's written the lyrics.
Yeah, then I got excited.
No.
Yeah.
I mean, we are writing music around it. There's not a lot there on the charts.
No, it's really interesting because I couldn't really tell what links there were. We're good. Sorry, we're actually in the middle of a podcast. Yeah. Brilliant. So this is the third and final gig of the...
It's not final. We've only just started the project.
It already sounds really polished. Like, if it were an album, I'd be like, cool.
Thanks a lot.
It's an album.
I mean, it's quite... It's very beautiful, but very very simple music. So it's very easy to sort of quickly become comfortable on it, I think.
Yeah.
And there's just a lot of options written into the tunes. They're basically all just strong melodies. And maybe a bass note here and there.
Was it easy to track the tunes down?
Yeah, there's a book of them all. It's like some, I think his some relation of his made the book. Like it's like a real book of Paul Motion.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, it's really nice.
Right, so this little pub here, The Moon Underwater, this is where we used to come when I was 17 to try and get a beer.
It's a Wetherspoon.
Yeah, it's bad. It's really bad.
Is there not a slightly nicer?
No, I just was panicking. We're on Deansgate now. This whole strip, this is like the Vegas Strip equivalent of Manchester. I think this is the end. Let's talk about Star Trek. Rob out.